Greetings from Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. As we record this podcast, I recognize and acknowledge that I'm located on the traditional territories of the Mississauga and Haudenosaunee nations and within the lands protected by the Dish with One Spoon Wampum Agreement. I am Selina Mudawanu.
Greetings from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I would like to take this opportunity to acknowledge the traditional territories of the people of the Treaty 7 region in southern Alberta. The city of Calgary is also home to Métis Nation of Alberta, Districts 5 and 6. I am Motilola Akinfemisoye Adejare.
Welcome to the Black Professors Podcast.
Selina and I are faculty members who are trained in media and communication studies.
And we worked in radio and television broadcasting at some point in our careers.
Our interests include digital storytelling, radio, and alternative media forms. On the podcast, Black professors will be asked about their pathways into academia and how they found themselves in their areas of specializations. They will also be asked to talk about the political, social, and other contexts that impacted their decisions to enter academia.
They'll be asked to share stories about their research and teaching trajectories, high and low lights in their careers, awards and grants they won, courses they developed, as well as their current research and teaching interests.
These professors will be invited to give advice to young people in Black communities and to their early career colleagues on successfully navigating the academy.
The professors will also be requested to speak about their favorite foods, hobbies, holiday destinations, as well as how they endeavor to maintain the work-life balance. Thank you so much, Professor Ibao, for joining us today. Professor Bonnie Ibao is currently the Vice Provost International Affairs and Professor of Global Human Rights and African Studies at McMaster University.
He holds the Senator William McMaster Chair in Global Human Rights. He is a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada and Expert Rapporteur, United Nations Expert Mechanism on the Rights to Development, UNOHCR, and the Founding Director, Center for Human Rights and Restorative Justice at McMaster University.
Professor Ibao, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
So, Professor Ibao, when we emailed you and we requested that we have an interview with you, why did you not hesitate to say yes?
Well, for me, first, I thought it was a great initiative. As I was telling you before we started recording, we need to do more telling of our stories as Africans and people of African descent. And, you know, we don't often get the platform to do so. As academics, we write books, we write journal articles, but it's often about other subjects. You know, rarely do we get time for introspection, for kind of reflection. And I thought this was a wonderful opportunity to do just that.
Thank you very much. And absolutely, stories, in fact, matter a lot. And speaking about stories, had you always wanted to be an academic?
Yeah, in some ways, yes. You know, my early inspiration, my dad was a civil servant and my mom was a teacher, a high school teacher. And so from a very young age, I was surrounded by academics, whether they were, you know, secondary school teachers. My dad had also dabbled in teaching before he joined the civil service. So Education was also very important. But I think the point at which I decided, you know, this is something I may want to do was when I got to secondary school. And I had a principal, a particular principal, Dr. J. Oitoto at high school. He had a PhD in education. He drove a Mercedes-Benz at the time, you know. Not teachers didn't drive Mercedes-Benzes, they drew, you know. This was the preserve of ministers and senior civil servants. But here was the principal of my Catholic school called Immaculate Conception College, who had a PhD, drove a Mercedes-Benz, and lived on a beautiful house on the hill, right in the school premises. So in some ways, I saw an academic that was inspiring, but also in a way lived the kind of, yes, modest, frugal life, but dignified experience. And he was always traveling, you know. One day he will be in Korea and he will come back at assembly and tell us tales of his trip. The next day he'll bring Hare Krishna people to school to speak to us about world religions. So I was very lucky to have that man as my principal and as someone I looked forward to in terms of what an academic could be, and not just in terms of his lifestyle, but also the impact he had on society. He was also very well respected, you know, in church. He was always, you know, given the front row seats and all of that. And for a young, impressionable man, that was something I liked a lot.
So take us a little bit back to your secondary education and your post-secondary education. Where did you study and how did you end up at McMaster?
That's an interesting one. So I attended Catholic schools all through my education. You know, my dad was a very ardent Catholic. Again, this is a legacy of colonialism. My region of Nigeria was the missionaries for whom my region was assigned were the Jesuits. So the British had these policy of assigning particular missionary groups to particular regions. So in the north of Nigeria, for instance, the missionaries were not allowed to go there. That was Muslim territory. And you know, following British divide and rule policy, that was going to remain the terrain of the Muslims. There could be no proselytization there. But in the southern part of Nigeria, the Catholics were allowed the Midwest, which is where I come from, and the Anglicans were allowed the West. So I happen to have grown up, although I'm in the middle of tropical Africa, in a very Catholic home. My dad was a papal knight, if you know what a papal knight is. These are people who are invested with some sword and badge and, you know, by the Pope, and they're supposed to be a custodians of the dignity of the church. Goes back to the Crusades and all of that. But anyway, what it meant was that I had a very Catholic upbringing, and so I attended Catholics nursery school, primary school, and secondary school, the Immaculate Conception College, you know, run by Carmelites and Jesuit priests. And so my education was framed by those experiences of Catholic traditions. And so that really shaped my worldview in terms of my understanding of the world. And in some ways, it also brought a bit of cosmopolitanism to how I saw the world, even in my secondary school days, because I had Indians as teachers, I had Irish, I had British, and I had Nigerians. It was a Catholic school, but it was in a way very cosmopolitan, and that's where it started. So before the internet, I could count on priests, you know, bringing Reader's Digests from England that I could read. You know, give you a window into the world, speak about Irish traditions and all of that. So that's where it all started. And then after that, my education in Nigeria was all in Nigeria until my PhD. And then I went abroad where the surgeon continued.
Thank you very much for sharing, and super inspiring to hear about all those who lit the torch for you to follow. Very, very interesting and super exciting. I just wanted to ask you too, what are some of the key highlights in your career in your surgeon so far?
Yeah, quite some. First and foremost, the fact that the journey into academia was a convoluted one. Like most Africans of my generation, of my time, it had to be the difficult way around. So I started off as a lecturer in Nigeria after my university education. I was very interested in human rights, but about a year into getting this job as a lecturer, a junior lecturer, it's called a graduate assistant at the time. My university was closed by the military government at the time because apparently my university and a few others had become hotbeds of activism against the military dictatorship in Nigeria at the time. And so it was closed for 6 months, no salary, nothing. And here I was, landed my dream job teaching human rights. And one day I hear on the news that the following six universities have been closed. And that was it. You go home. What do you do? So I started doing what many of my colleagues did. I started working with NGOs, writing reports, doing research just to survive. And that was really the journey out of Nigeria. I never planned to leave the country. And so I first ended up at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London on a fellowship. And then I was at the Danish Institute for Human Rights in Copenhagen. And then I was at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs in New York. And that's the story, just I say we were all migrant laborers, no different from those in the mines. Just we're intellectual migrant laborers. A fellowship here, a postdoc there, and it was all international. You pack your bags and you were in Europe at one point, and you're in Scandinavia, and you're in the US, and you're back in Canada until I land. But to answer your question, I think the most significant part of my career really wasn't the academic part. It was that early program officer years as a human rights officer, working with the Danish Institute for Human Rights in Copenhagen. And it's a very hands-on human rights job. My job was to travel around the world as a program officer, write reports about human rights condition. And so in some ways, that approach to human rights still shapes my scholarship. It gave me an opportunity to really got my hands dirty in terms of, practical human rights work. And it has shaped everything since then. So even when I write books about human rights, I'm always thinking, well, what does this mean for a practitioner? How does this resonate with those who have to do the real work of human rights advocacy?
That is so important. But to just take you back a little bit, the decision to focus on human rights and African studies, and you are a professor in a history department. How did that come about? How did you decide, I want to study history, I want to study human rights, this is where my passions are? How did that come about?
Yeah, so some of this, like most things in life, part of it is intentional. Part of it is just chance, opportunities come, you're in the right place at the right time. So I've always been interested in human rights. I came of age in Nigeria at a very difficult time, a military dictatorship, one of the worst we've had. Thankfully, the country is now a fledgling democracy. But in the 1990s, it was a difficult place to be, an academic and all of that. But so I was always interested in that. In fact, I was teaching human rights in the university at the time. But I think what really got me thinking more about human rights at a very personal level, like I said, was when my university was closed by the military dictators, and I could see firsthand what it meant, in terms of how it affected your life. So for the first year, for instance, I couldn't travel abroad. So if I remember getting a couple of fellowships, and I'll get to the airport, and in one incident, the security officer said, "Oh, where are you going?" I said, "I'm going for a conference." I was wise enough not to say a human rights conference. But then he said, "What do you do?" And I said, "I'm a lecturer." I said, "Ah, you're the ones giving all our bosses trouble, and we're not going to let you go." So the arbitrariness of authoritarian governance was one you felt at a very personal level, and I always felt that they had to do more. The other motivation for me was, although I do African studies and I do international human rights, I was also very interested in telling human rights from an African perspective, but with global resonance. I wasn't interested in just talking about human rights in Africa. I was talking about human rights in Africa, yes, but the place of Africa in global human rights. So it was very important for me to frame my scholarship in terms of global human rights. Yes, my window is Africa, but my contribution, my intellectual contributions are universal. And even when I worked as a program officer in the nonprofit sector, in human rights organizations, I was always emphasizing that, challenging norms, global norms, and thinking through what I, as someone who brings an African lens to what we consider a universal topic, what I can contribute, what does the African lens bring to these global debates?
Absolutely interesting. Thank you so much, Bonnie, for those very insightful comments. And we can tell that you've taken opportunities and chances as they have come, especially that you grew up during military dictatorship in Nigeria. What would you say, to advise students, young people today who, are starting out in their careers or who are just still studying? What advice would you give them on how to navigate themselves, in the world, wherever they find themselves?
Very, very good question. I was asked that question a different way recently. So, actually, a student asked me, "What advice will you give to a 21-year-old you?" And I never thought about it that way before. I'm like, well, yeah, I think my impulsive answer was, if you haven't figured it all out, that's okay. There's so much pressure now to have it all figured out. And I think maybe not as much as this generation, but I faced a bit of that too. And I look back and I say, wow, that was so unnecessary because, things work themselves out, it's always good to be intentional about what you want to do, find your passion, but also don't be so fixated on that that you miss the opportunities that come along the way. So it's like, I am laser focused on going to medical school. It's medical school or bust. I'm laser focused on, I wanted to go to law school at some point, and I did go to law school ultimately, but that was not what came first. An opportunity came, to go do human rights work as a program officer, and I took that first. So my advice will be, one, don't be too anxious about not figuring it out. That's the first thing. Secondly, even though it's ideal and desirable to be intentional, watch out for the opportunities. The universe has a way of throwing things across your path, nudging you here and there, to go in different directions. Listen to that, take the road less traveled every once in a while. And, the opportunities, I read somewhere that half of the jobs that will exist in 2050 have not yet been created, just with AI and all these new technologies. We don't even know what opportunities will be out there. So in some ways, you have to leave room for that and say, yeah, these are my plans, but if these opportunities come, maybe I'll take them. So that would be my advice, because that's certainly what happened to me. It wasn't, working in Denmark, working in the UK, working in New York was certainly not part of my plan, but as the opportunities came, you took that. One last thing, and this is something that comes up very often. They say, do what you love and you'll never have to work a day in your life. And sometimes people think that is very idealistic, you know, and all of that. Sometimes you can do what you want and all of that. And I get that. But I think we also need to recognize the idea behind that saying isn't that you have to be fixated on getting what you want. It is more that that should be your aspiration. So you might not get what you want right now. You might have to do what you have to do to put food on the table, but don't lose sight of the fact that the goal is ultimately to do what you want. And that is the work that you need to do. That's what you need to carry on, inspiring you.
That is fantastic. What advice would you give to a young person who has just gotten a position as an academic in a university in terms of research, in terms of teaching? How do they navigate the space between being hired and getting promoted?
The first thing I always advise young faculty members is understand your space. Know what is expected of you, know what the space is. Spend time to understand the expectations. And yes, we have general assumptions about what academic life should be, but you and I know that very often it differs significantly from institution to institution, from country to country. So it depends on where you find yourself and understanding that space, you know. So for instance, I say, you know, if you're in a research intensive institution, understand that that's going to be the driver for your success. A lot of people might pay lip service to, oh, community engagement. And we do a lot of this as, you know, Black and minority people. But very often, the academia has really not developed a way to recognize that on par with traditional research publication. So the universities pay lip service to community engagement and all of that nice things, you know, community work, service. They tell you is it 20% or 30%? But I've sat in enough tenure committees to know that at the end of the day, it's counting the publication. So you have to know that if you're in a research institution. And if you are in a teaching institution where the primary goal is, you know, teach, 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 you also have to tailor your agenda towards that. And then another thing that's professionally, lean on others, lean on community. I think for me, one of the things I learned very early on in my career is to build community. You're stronger together. And that's why, you know, a few years after I got here, I worked with Julia Daniel to found ACFAM, the African Caribbean Faculty Association, because we realized very early on that your voice would get heard. You're always going to be a minority to begin with, unless you had a platform. And so we said, well, we are only four, I think we're about four or five Black faculty at the time. And we said, we're only four. We're going to form this association. What's it going to be? A caucus, a group, whatever. We'll form something, and that will be our voice. So when we want to make representation, it'll be our voice. And I also remember something very interesting, and I have to give Juliet the credit for this. It wasn't me. Juliet would always insist that we meet in the faculty club. Now, if you remember, the faculty club is this exclusive place. You don't just walk in there. You have to be a member. You have to, you know, and all of that. It was this rarefied space of academia. And you often never found people, you know, minority people there. Not that we weren't allowed, you know, it just wasn't a space we went to. But Juliet would always say, well, the four of us, when we're having our meetings, we'll go to the faculty club and we'll sit in the middle of the biggest room and we'll have our meetings there. I'm like, why, Juliet? Why do we have to do this? Could we just four people, we can meet him up and say, no, we have to occupy space. People have to know we're here. They have to see us. They have to. And I wasn't sold on that, I have to be frank. But with time, I saw what she was talking about, that it's about representation. And that's why sometimes when, you know, I go as Vice Provost International, I try to make convocation all the time, not because, you know, I enjoy sitting at convocation, but I see the value of representation. And I think all faculty members, Black and racialized faculty members should consider that in the kind of work we do. Just being there, there might be the inspiration that a student of color needs to begin to think about life as an academia. So my advice would be lean on community. It helps.
Wow, that's excellent advice. Thank you so much, Bonnie. That takes me to my next question for postdocs, those who recently completed PhDs, who want to land this dream academic position. What advice have you got for them, Bonnie?
Networks, very important, particularly for postdocs, but also for a young faculty. It goes back to the point I made earlier about visibility, representation, and occupying space. People have to know you're there. For a postdoc, and we all know this, the way postdoc work is that you're working in a very small group. They are often attached to labs, or you are, attached to a project. It's the recommendation often comes from the professors who know you, who say, well, can vouch for you. And your professor knows you because of your interaction, not just your academic work, but also your social space, how engaged you are with the scholarly community. And I know this is not something that comes to us naturally because often, I mean, let's face it, you go to that space, you're the only Black person or a couple of you, and you're thinking, it looks like work. It's a social space. You have to think about that as part of career development. So don't think about it as a social event if you don't have to. Think about it as an extension of my career development. So I'm going to attend that cocktail, not because I really want a glass of wine, not because I'm super eager to hang out with these people, but it's essential to my career development. So it takes an attitudinal shift to say, okay, I need to do this, particularly if you're going to be in a place where, frankly, it might not align with your own culture. So you have to be able to navigate multiple cultural registers, even as a postdoc, and so I always push, even now with COVID, I can see my PhD students opting instinctively for virtual participation at conferences. I say, okay, so what did you go to Los Angeles like we planned? Oh no, I decided to join virtually. I'm like, no, you're not going to have those hallway conversations if you're on Zoom. You need to get there. And so my advice to postdoc is try, you've done well academically, you have the publication, you have the resume, but you also have to think about academia as a social space. And it's even more important in academia because we have tenure. So the stakes are higher. And so those four colleagues who are sitting at the table interviewing you, they're not just interviewing another worker, you're not a staff. They're interviewing someone who they're going to be stuck with for the rest of their lives. So you have to think about it that way. And so the stakes are very high. Is there someone that, so you, and that's why for academics, there are most three or four series of interviews. You get the lecture, you get the presentation, you go for dinner, you go for lunch. And it's all for that reason, because at the end of the day, you're part of a community. And so you have to position yourself as someone who's fit or who will be able to work within those kinds of very diverse communities. So that would be my advice.
So what advice would you give to somebody who has been in a different education system and is trying to land a tenure track job in Canada?
So that's a very good question because I actually have an example of some of the challenges that this poses. So, not long ago, there was an interview for a position and my previous institution. And the top applicant was someone, from Africa and a relatively new migrant. And everyone agreed that they were exceptional. They interviewed well. The lecture was wonderful. The presentation was top class. But But the search committee reported that he tended to be socially awkward. He didn't say much at the dinner. He didn't seem like someone who could get along well with the colleagues and all of that. So he was eventually hired just because he was so exceptional in the other areas. And so once I got to know him and he settled to the department, I talked to him and I said, "Yeah, you did so well. What happened?" And he responded was, "They were talking about baseball all day, and I knew nothing of baseball. I didn't know what to say." And it dawned on me, and even those in the search committee later realized that he's a very conversational, very friendly person, but he's operating from a position of relative powerlessness. And here are all these top professors who take him out to dinner, talking about the baseball game and all the ins. And I too know nothing about baseball. And the poor guy just kept quiet. And, had it been soccer or football, I'm sure he would have said something. But what that tells me is that, again, to the point about educating ourselves to prepare ourselves for the market, if he were that savvy, he would have steered the conversation away to what he knows and said, "Oh, well, you're talking about baseball. How does that really compare with soccer?" And then you can get a conversation going. So what my advice would be, do not ignore the cultural nuances. It's important to understand the cultural nuances of being an academic here. It could be just something as simple as the expectation of the workplace, the cultural nuances. And I give you an example. I started my academic career in the UK, and there, intellectual modesty is a virtue. I remember my first CV was about 3 or 4 pages long, and my professor chastised me in London and said that was braggadocious. Academics are humble, and you go on and on, and nobody's going to take you serious. And I get to North America, and the first lesson that gets drilled into me is nobody will blow your trumpet unless you do so yourself. Everything here is in the superlatives. The best students I've taught in my lifetime. One of the top three students in the whole world. Like someone actually said, that everyone in the class is above average. Making nonsense of the meaning of average to begin with. That's not America for you. So you have to understand that. So if you're in the, in the European system, which is a little bit more understated in what is expected of an academic, and you're submitting a 25-page CV for TMP, that might be seen as, kind of presumptuous. But if you submit a 3-page CV in North America, nobody's going to take you seriously. So I think it's really understanding. And how do you do that? Community. It's community. It's not going to be something written in a document. It's community. It's talking to like-minded people, finding mentors that you can speak to. It's often the unspoken that are the indices of success. Not what's in the yellow document. By the way, the yellow document is our tenure and promotion document here at McMaster. Every university has one. It's the yellow document does not have all the answers. It's those little, tips that you get when you speak to people in the informal settings of community.
That is so insightful. Thank you so much, Bonnie. I'm going to steer this ship a little bit away from this very academic, interesting, and exciting conversations and move to one superlative as well. So, what's your favorite food? What will be that bowl that would be the definition of the most amazing meal that you would enjoy?
Yeah, so that this is a really interesting one. We switch codes, right? To survive in the academia. So I always have, the Western code and the authentic African code. So I'll crave your indulgence to name two.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so if I'm in my, Nigerian setting, maybe no friends invite me over for their daughter or son's wedding ceremony and all of that. Oh my God, it's going to be pounded yam with a goosey soup and
Correct.
something very traditional, garnished with, vegetables and all of that. My Nigerian brothers will know exactly what I'm talking about.
I
And
do.
maybe some jollof rice, which is that would be my favorite food. But in terms of Western cuisine, there's a very simple dish that I really, really like, and that's fries, but not the regular potato fries, yam fries.
Oh,
It's kind of yam fries and egg sauce.
excellent.
So,
That's
in terms of travel, you've traveled quite a bit in your career and in your life. Which destination would you say you have enjoyed the most?
So I think for me, for the longest time, it was not so much that I enjoyed it the most, but maybe we'll say an awakening was Denmark. I left Nigeria, worked in the UK, and I went to Denmark. And Scandinavia could, on the face of it, be no more different than Africa. It's so different. The weather is cold. The people are tall, blue-eyed, blonde. They just says it could be a different world. But in my 2, 3 years in Scandinavia, I began to see how so much similar the cultures were. The idea of the folk, the Volk, I would go to these folk festivals and, people would gather around in the countryside, Frederiksberg or Aarhus or some, part of. And the kids will gather around and they'll be telling stories with candlelights, with a bonfire. And they will sing songs and they'll clap hands. And I'll be told that these songs go back to the ancient Vikings, to the Nordic kings, and it talks about their saga and all of that. And I began to see these people aren't so different because I can relate to so much of what is happening here. And so for me, living in Denmark was an eye-opener, that it's so different yet so familiar, and I made so many friends there. I think those were very interesting days for me. But in terms of where I go, I just feel at home, apart from going to Africa, it's Barbados. I don't know, for some reason, Barbados just it has that rusticness, but it's the one place that, if I had to escape, I tell my colleague Juliet all the time that I have to, she has to find me a cottage in Barbados. She's originally from there. It's a beautiful place. It's a small place, and you feel the sense of community in in Barbados. So that would be one of my favorite places in the world.
Excellent. It's so interesting. And as you spoke about the storytelling that you experienced and enjoyed at Denmark, it reminded me of my time to growing up in Ibadan, Tales by Moonlight, my parents.
I remember that on TV, Tales by Moonlight. And the
Yeah.
stories are so familiar, the great king and the sojourns and the conflict and redemption. It's like they cut from the same cloth, same template. It reminds you of
Absolutely.
our collective humanity.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, if I was to ask you a question about your favorite hobbies, I can hear that you've enjoyed traveling a lot and you have done a lot of that. What are some of your favorite hobbies?
I paint. I do painting. I have a small studio in my basement. I've always loved painting. Some of the paintings that I've done in my homes, I did myself. I gift paintings to friends when I get the time. I don't get much time to do paintings these days. But painting is something that I like to do. It's relaxing. And yeah, so I really do enjoy painting.
We have not talked about your work as Vice Provost International. Can you talk us through when you started this role and some of the highlights of the kind of work that you do?
Yeah, so the first thing I have to say, people ask me about my administrative career. I dabble in administration. I'm not a real administrator. So I do 1 term and then I leave and go live my life as an academic. I never do 2 terms. So, I was an associate dean and then I was acting vice provost for research for the university for a while. I go in when I feel I can contribute. There's something to do. And then I do it for 5 years, and then I absolutely don't want to stay a day longer there. I want to just go back. So for the vice provost position, I took that on about a year and a half ago now. Before then, I was running a center, the Center for Human Rights, which I founded. And the reason why I did this was because I really thought I could contribute with my team a bit to internationalization at McMaster University. One of the things that I've been struck by is the fact that internationalization has now become synonymous with bringing high fee paying students to Canadian universities. And that's not my idea of internationalization. I call it the resource extractive model of internationalization. And my vision was for what I call a values-based model of internationalization. And, I theorize about this, I've written about this. And so this was an opportunity to see how do you practicalize a values-based approach to internationalization, given real resource constraint, So my job really is to lead international office with a vision of diversifying first our international student body, internationalizing our curriculum, and forging partnerships in a way that affirms these values-based approach to internationalization that I talk about. So that's what I've been doing. I just came back from Lagos, Nigeria, a couple of days ago. And what we're doing there, we're signing memorandum of understanding with the research consortium of African universities. There's a consortium of African research universities, and we're working with other Canadian and American and European universities to sign a consortium for mutual exchange, research partnership. So that's what I do, and that's really taken me it's taken most of my time now. And of course, I combine that with my role in the United Nations. So that international dimension, I think it goes back to this point I made earlier about Africa's place in the world. Not just the world's place in Africa, but Africa's place in the world. What can you do that has international resonance that goes beyond just your research interests or what you're trained to do? How can you bring that to global conversations? And that also guides my approach to my administrative work.
Excellent. Thank you so very much for sharing. I just wondered if there was something else that you would like to say that we might not have asked you.
I think for me, the most important one personally is giving back to the community engagement. We have these ongoing debates about what's the purpose of academia, art for art's sake or art with a purpose. Now you have colleagues who would argue very vigorously for a space for art for art's sake. The topic doesn't have to have any meaning. It doesn't have to contribute to anything. You do it just for the sake of it. And I understand that. But I always say that's also a luxury. If in a context where I have subsistence issues, I come from a space where we need to real world solution to real world problems, and we don't have the, we'll get there, but we don't yet have that luxury of art for art's sake. It must have meaning. That's my personal view. And so I always say, as an academic, we are so incredibly privileged. We've got tenure, even the worst of economies, at least if you've tenure, you don't have to worry about that. You have freedom to do your own thing. It's amazing. And it's, you think about that and you just say, it can be free. You've got to give something back. We can have all this privilege. Just one last thing, people ask, what's my favorite quotation? And my favorite quotation, it's not from some renowned philosopher or historian or legal scholar. It's from the boxer Muhammad Ali, who you might know, not very well educated, but he had a way with words. And he said, service to others is the rent we pay for our time here on earth. And I find that so profound because for me, it answers the question, what's the meaning of life? Why am I here? You're here because you enjoy all these wonderful benefits of life, of health, of means, a beautiful world. You've got to pay for it. It's not free. And what's that payment? You don't have to be religious to understand that it's leaving the place a little bit better than you found it, and that's service to others. So it's that obligation that we have as very privileged academics to leave our communities. It doesn't have to be the world. We don't have to be some big, it could be just your immediate community, living it a little bit better than it was before you came.
Thank you so much, Bonnie, for taking the time. And that's why I could not miss it at all. Even though I had a class, I thought we have to make this happen. Thank
Yeah,
you so
thank
much for
you.
all the support that you've given us by just showing up.
Thank
Yes.
you very much. I share, I share, I share.
That is all we had in this episode.
Join us next time.
And be sure to follow us on our various social media platforms. The Black Professors Podcast was established in the summer of 2023 as a space to share the often untold stories by Black professors who take us behind the scenes of their career trajectories. The co-executive producers of the Black Professors Podcast are
Dr. Selina Mudavanu, Communication Studies and Media Arts Department, McMaster University.
and Dr. Motilola Akinfemisoye Adejare, African Studies Program, University of Calgary. The production team includes undergraduate and graduate students.
The title of the track used in the podcast is Podcast Hip Hop Intro Short by Corporate Sounds, accessed via Jamendo. Our sincere gratitude to the Pulse Lab at McMaster University for graciously allowing us to use the podcast recording equipment. The Black Professors Podcast is supported by generous funding from McMaster University's Arts Research Board.